We're going to open to Genesis chapter 12 and continue our story about the father of faith. Genesis chapter 12, verse number 10 says, "Now there was a famine in the land." Now the land in mind here is the land of Canaan. We know that Abram left Ur, left Haran, came south into the land of Canaan and kind of worked his way through a couple of different places during more than likely the first year that he was in Canaan. That year I put at 2101 BC. And if you're interested in my chronology, check out intotheword2020.com and the chronological companion resource that is located at that site. We don't know how long it was until this famine popped up, but it probably was pretty quick. And Abram makes a personal choice here that is not necessarily what God wanted him to do. And that is, verse 10, Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Egypt is the breadbasket of the eastern Mediterranean. It's not impacted by the weather patterns of the Mediterranean because it is fed, the Nile River is fed by water from the monsoons deep down in Africa. So there's pretty much always food, always grain there. So he chooses to go there while the famine is going on in Canaan. He only expects to be there a short period of time, perhaps a year or maybe two at the most, is what he was likely looking at. But here's the other free will choice that he made. Verse 11, when he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life might be spared for your sake." And as I explained last time, the idea that he has in mind here is if the Egyptians perceive him as a husband of a very beautiful woman, then one of them might actually murder or manipulate the legal system to have him executed so that they could have Sarai, the beautiful lady from Mesopotamia, as their wife. But if she is perceived as his unmarried sister, they will treat him nicely, hoping to get on his good side because he has a lot to say about who his unmarried sister would get married to. And the plan did work fairly well until something he wasn't expecting happened. Verse 14, when Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. When the princes of the pharaohs saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. As long as Abram was dealing with peers, he really didn't have too much to fear because they would have, as I said, wanted to be on his good side so that they might have a chance to marry his beautiful sister. But when you've got a superior that does not see the need to ask for your permission before they act, then you're in trouble. And so that's exactly where Pharaoh is. Pharaoh is, of course, the king of Egypt. He is a very powerful leader of all of the lords of Egypt. And so when he sees this presumed single woman, very beautiful, the sister of a very powerful, clearly, Mesopotamian prince who has come into the land recently, he just simply assumes, "I can marry her," and makes the arrangements for her to be moved into his palace as he continues to make the arrangements for the wedding. And He also continues to treat his future brother-in-law very well. Verse 16, for her sake he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. So he is treating Abram very well because he sees him as part of the family. But then God has to step in. And isn't this exactly what has to happen sometimes in our lives? We of our own free will make some very poor choices, and we get into a mess. We thought we were doing okay. We thought we were making good plans for our own benefit to protect ourselves, and then the things we didn't plan for start happening. And we cry out to the Lord for help, and of his own choosing, he sometimes will intervene and get us out of the mess. So Abram, and keep in mind, he's a very young believer. He has probably only been a believer in the one true God for a matter of years. Now think about how you were acting when you were only a few years old in your Christian faith. Were you fully mature and always made good choices based on your relationship with God and based on the scripture? No, neither did I. And so he's having a tough time. And so God has mercy on him and helps him out. Now, how does he help him out? Verse 17. But he who is afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, what does that mean? I think the later story in Genesis chapter 20 might provide some insight for this. Not guaranteeing that. Just want you to know this is my opinion, but it is based on some material that will come up in chapter 20, where Abram didn't learn a lesson, or at least didn't learn the full lesson from this previous event, and he does the exact same thing again. He tries to pass Sarai off as his unmarried sister. Somebody that has some clout ends up assuming that they can marry her, and God has to step in again. And in the Genesis chapter 20, we know what the plagues were. The word plague in our English version just represents like a swat. It's related to that idea of corporal punishment that God gave Pharaoh a little warning swat that you need to knock it off what you're doing right now, because I'm not going to put up with it. The Genesis 20 passage says this in verse 18, for he who is had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So God had intervened in the fertility of not just simply the Lord in that story later, but of the members of his household, staff and family, even maybe the animals, that suddenly nobody's getting pregnant. We also have this added development depth that is not in the Genesis 12 passage we're looking at, but might be there in between the lines, and that is God actually appeared to Abimelech in the Genesis 20 story and said, "Don't you touch her." And some have even suggested that God might have made it physically impossible for Abimelech to have had any type of sexual relationship with Sarah, and that God was going to have to pull back on all of that at the end of the story when Abraham prays on their behalf and God restores everything to the way it was before Sarah was taken to Abimelech's house. All right, so taking that information, if that is what's going on in Genesis chapter 12, verse 17, then Pharaoh gets the heads up. Perhaps God appears to him in a dream after he starts developing sexual dysfunction himself, and he finds out that all the members of his household staff, perhaps even his animals, none of them are able to reproduce suddenly. And God appears in a dream and says, you want to know why that's happening? It's because you think that you can marry that man's wife. And so, verse 18, Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? And Genesis 20, same thing. Abimelech is really upset. He's actually chewing Abraham out at that point, saying, why did you let me do this thing? You are part of the problem here. And so I think you can see that in Pharaoh's comments as well, is why didn't you stand up for yourself, man? What are you trying to do? Pass her off as an unmarried sister. That's not right. It's not fair. Now, one of the things I didn't comment on yet, and that was that Abram was assuming something that was not necessarily true. And that is, if these guys down here in Egypt see my beautiful wife, they are very likely to kill me and take her. Well, that's making a pretty big assumption that they are that wicked. And when you read the after story, both here in Genesis 12 and in Genesis chapter 20, it doesn't appear to be the case that these guys didn't feel that they would have tried to take her if they had known she was already married and unavailable. All right, so back to the story in Genesis 12. Let's read 18 again. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, she's my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. And so he is expelled from the land of Egypt. Now, how long did he spend there? We don't know. But now he is headed back to Canaan, perhaps back into what remains of the famine time. And he has, he's gained maybe a few possessions because of the kindnesses that were shown to him when everybody thought that she was his unmarried sister. But now he's ready to go back to his work as a Bedouin shepherd lord, where he moves himself and his flocks to different areas to take advantage of the resources that are available. Chapter 13. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the Negeb. Now, remember again, the Negeb, that's the Old Testament name for the southern Palestine or Judean or Canaanite desert. So it's right there just below where Hebron is, basically, just south of Hebron. And it's the upper or northern portion of the Sinai Peninsula desert. So right there in that borderland area of scrub before it becomes more fertile fields to the north. He's got his nephew with him, and they've got lots of animals. Verse 2, now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. He is a very powerful, important person. And he is effectively just moving a small city with him everywhere he goes because everybody that works for him as shepherds and cattle persons and all the support personnel and the families of those people, the children and maybe some of the retired from active work parents of some of these people. Everywhere he's going, he's a small city on the move, a little tent city. So he journeyed on from the Negeb, as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at first. And there Abram called upon the name of He Who Is. So he goes back to his second worship site once he'd arrived in the land of Canaan. And he establishes his little tent city there at the future site of Bethel and Ai, which is going to be the first big battle site after the Jericho fight when the Israelis come into the Promised Land. And Bethel, that was not its name at this time. It gets that name in the story of Jacob, who comes to this very same site and sees a vision of God's angels going back and forth between his throne room and planet Earth doing his work. And he names it Beth, which means house, El, house of God, because this is the very gate of God. It's an entry point between the two dimensions. So that is this site. It is a worship site for Abram. And the indication is that he just starts his routine, day in, day out, of having all of his flocks and his herds all taken care of. They might have planted some fields of grain near their little tent city, but for the most part, they're working with the animals, trying to get them to provide the living that they need. Now, verse 5 tells us that Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. Now, the population of Canaan at this time is not monstrous. It's not huge by our standards. I'm guessing, and I've told you this before, that probably in the entire Middle East, there may have been 100,000 or so people. Probably in the entire world, there may have only been between 100 and 150 million peoples. So there are communities, cities, little walled cities with communities right around them scattered all over the area of Canaan. But those communities are probably only thousands of people into the low tens of thousands of people for a really big walled city. And Abram is out in the wilderness away from those cities trying to graze his animals. And Lot is nearby. And even though they're kind of stretched away from each other, they're close enough that they are competing for the same resources, the same grazing spots. And that leads to verse 7. There was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And at that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. And we're always being reminded, the Israelis are not living here at this time. This is all about the Canaanites of the different types that God was going to eventually order to leave because of their sinfulness. So what do you do when your business concerns are bumping heads with a friend or a relative's business concerns? You try to come up with some sort of compromise. You try to come up with an idea of how can we both still continue prospering, but not at the expense of each other. Verse 8, so Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me, between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we're kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I'll go to the right. And if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left. So Abram is very gracious. He's very kind. And since he's the older man in this story, the older member of the family, he allows the younger party to choose. Very kind of him. And so he tells his nephew, I don't want us having this problem anymore. You just pick someplace, and I'll make sure I don't encroach on your grazing lands. All right? Sounds like a deal, right? And so Lot is now faced with a personal choice. You know, free will comes into the story of the Bible over and over and over again. And more often than not, it's free will that causes trouble. Isn't that interesting? Free will is like a blessing curse. It's a blessing when you do the right thing and a curse when you choose the wrong thing. So Lot opened up his eyes and he saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of He Who Is, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. Now, this was before He Who Is destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, that last phrase there is a historical notation by Moses to the Israelites who may have already seen the Jordan Valley in its current situation as they were making their trips. And that is, it's dry. It is a below sea level desert region. And that's the way it has been even to this present day. And it's because of something that happened in the past. Now, the evolutionary geologists will tell you that at some point in the past, the entire Great Gore, G-H-O-R, I believe is the way you spell it, the entire Gore dropped below sea level, and this is what formed the Dead Sea. This is what formed the Jordan Valley going up to the Sea of Galilee, because Sea of Galilee is also 600-some feet below sea level. But the Gore also goes down through the great Red Sea Gulf of Aqaba, and down even into northeastern Africa. And it's a great big geological fault line. They will tell you that happened millions of years ago. I have my doubts about that. And this is the passage that makes me doubt that. It says here that when Lot looked at the Jordan Valley from where he and Abram are at Bethel, that it was very well watered. Well, that's not what you would see now from that perspective. You would see how things drop off precipitously into the Jordan Valley, and having done so, it is very dry, except for right up next to the Jordan River. If you will get out something like Google Earth, if you like to play with such things, you can actually fly around over there and see that on both sides of the Jordan Valley, you've got a gentle sloping terrain until suddenly it just dumps below sea level from somewhere like 800 feet over sea level to then suddenly down to 1,200 and below sea level. That's a huge drop-off. And you've got large erosion areas where what used to be rivers that must have fed into the Jordan River from the Central Highlands on both sides suddenly plunge very rapidly into the Jordan Valley. And they've eroded the sides of this great canyon terribly. So I am of the opinion, and that's all it's worth, folks, is that when Moses writes here at the Holy Spirit's direction, that the description of the Jordan Valley here is of the time before He Who Is destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, that it was the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that changed this pleasant perspective of the Jordan Valley. I think the Jordan Valley floor was above sea level and that there was no such thing as the Dead Sea. When we start talking about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we're going to talk about it being a catastrophe. It was a horrible overturning of the current situation. My thoughts are, and I'll go into more detail with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah later, is that there were once huge reservoirs of oil, petroleum, underneath Canaan in the Jordan Valley region, just as there are all over the Middle East. And that God vented and ignited those reserves right at ground zero of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that this is what caused the entire valley to drop suddenly below sea level. Well, we're out of time for the week and today, so I will see you next week when we get back into the Word. So mark your place and invite somebody to join you next time we get together.